Hello and welcome to No Killing Goblins. I am, as always, Dragonus, and my excellent co-host Oshin.
Oh, I don't get to say my own name. I always let you say your name.
Yeah, you know what? I had the better one, and then you know what? It was your fault we lost it. Anyways, everybody, we are here to finish up with Volume 3 today. I'm pretty excited.
I'm just salty right now.
What is there to be salty about?
The introduction! I've been erased by Dragonus. I've been erased. My only way of saying... Okay, I'm going to say it right now. I'm Oshi.
Well, I do believe that was made obvious.
Yeah, we're back talking about what we dropped off on literally a few minutes ago in real time. But however long it's been for you, I don't really want to talk about what we did this week because we didn't do anything. I want to talk about the episode's material.
Well, I do actually have a couple other things I could chat about just to help us, you know, talk a little bit about some other non-wandering in stuff.
I would appreciate that because I don't got. I'll think of something by the time you're done with your thing.
We have just sort of finished up a season of excellent anime. The new Gundam was great and hella gay. Honestly, I just could not get quite into it for various reasons. The setting didn't quite click with me, but it's Gundam and it's really high quality Gundam. It's got great characters. Some really spectacular mech design philosophy went into how they differentiated the corporations. Check it out. Chainsaw Man just finished, so nobody has to hear me complain about how they need to be watching more Chainsaw Man anymore. Now I'm just going to tell you to go read the manga. And I read a pretty interesting self-published book series recently. It's got two books out. I hesitate recommending the first one because it is a bit rough and uneven, especially the way that it escalates going into its ending. But the second book is so good, I got to talk about it. So, Oshi, have you ever heard of Dirk Cooper Paranormal Real Estate?
I think I've heard of it.
It is a story about a real estate agent who, through a great deal of personal misfortune and a bad gambling habit, has found himself a staggering amount of money in debt to people who you don't want to be in debt to.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing he has going for him is that he happens to be part of a very narrow niche of people within the real estate industry that, because he can see ghosts, he can help get them exorcised and sell your haunt property.
Uh-huh.
There's just one problem with this, Ocean.
I don't know.
Actual haunted houses are almost always out in the woods or in shitty parts of town. They're kind of run down. Like, it isn't great. So instead, he just finds ghosts and gets them to haunt houses for him so he can then pretend to get rid of them to sell them.
According to this, I like the reference to the housing crash of 2008. Oh, actually, I just thought of something we could talk about. It's a little depressing, but you know what? That's what millennials live through, so whatever.
Yeah, that's how he got so much in debt. He was doing real estate that was less scammy, but more high risk, you know, house flipping type of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And he had borrowed a amount of money that is never specifically stated, but probably has more zeros on it than common sense would dictate you should borrow from somebody who hunts men to death as sport. And then the housing crisis hit.
So
it has a great sense of humor. It does actually have, like, the wherewithal to really hit you and pull out some good emotion, mostly in the second book, though. The mystery is enjoyable. It's just generally good. It's got a great sense of humor. Check it out.
Yeah, that sounds great. I will check it out. Hopefully that didn't sound too sarcastic. I actually do mean I will check it out, because I already bought it on... I took it up on Kindle Unlimited. What was I gonna say? The millennial thing.
Housing crisis.
Housing crisis. So I've been reading, like... I've been reading a lot of year, and you know, at the end of a year, at the end of... Oh my god, did we forget to say Happy New Year to each other?
Oh, we did forget to say Happy New Year, which I guess comes from going so long. Because I was... I was fine over New Year's, although I was very hungover.
I did not do anything New Year's. I was sick all through New Year's until, like, January 2nd. All I did was play CK3, where I am committing some incredibly dubious acts. Not torture, just, you know, lots of inbreeding. or at least possibility of inbreeding. It takes a lot to get pure blood, okay?
Yeah, I think my New Year's, I did an anime movie night with some friends and watched the Fate Heavens Feel movies and drank a staggeringly ill-advised amount of pre-mixed margaritas.
That's a lot of margaritas.
But you were talking about the housing crisis?
Right, well, they did an end-of-year thing, and every article or anything I read about millennials, we're the pummeling bags of, like, generational whatever, because we all grew up through, like, crisis after crisis after crisis, and we're the first generation where we're gonna make less money, and we have less money, and we have less stuff, and we have to do everything less than the generation before us. And there is this continue. I don't know if it's fair to say this. I don't care if it's fair. I just needed the nice blanket of these self-confirming prophecies about how millennials are kind of fucked both ways. Because the people before us call us lazy, entitled assholes, while they're the ones who provided, who insisted on providing us, because they're our fucking parents, and our grandparents and all that stuff, providing us with all this shit and, like, being, why are you not doing more? Why are you not moving out? Well, let's see. You never sold the house that you live in, so because of that, we don't actually have a house that we can buy. Then maybe that might have to end. Maybe you should sell one of the four other houses you own. And the other aspect of it was, does Gen Z hates us because we aren't going far enough? We're too conservative because we've been, you know, had our money stolen, had our future taken, had the world burned down around us. And they're, like, demanding change now. So the younger generation hates us for not demanding enough change. The older generation hates us for not doing good enough.
I mean, I believe have just, as out of this year and a raise I just picked up, officially reached comfortably middle class, and I identify as Gen X anyways, so really this doesn't sound like it has anything to do with me.
You are not Gen X. How old could you possibly? You cannot be over 35.
I identify as Gen X.
Screw you, you're not Gen X. You're my generation.
I'm not even kidding. I grew up thinking of myself as a Gen Xer and making fun of millennials because I thought they were all younger than me. And, like, all of my older friends, because I've always wound up having friends that were at a gap age-wise, were all Gen X people. So just, like, that's what I think of myself as, like, if from a certain cultural perspective.
I just paid off my student loan. This year. Like, this year. It's been 14 years. It took that long to pay off my student loans. And I went to a poor college. Poor people's college.
Well, yeah. I
fuck
just
off,
school,
everybody.
I didn't want the fucking student loans.
Like, just... And I still have so many other loans and so much other credit card stuff. And my mother's loans and stuff. I just... My experience is very different from most people's. And... But there was a reason for this. So I read this article about how... Because of the continual, like, worldwide generational effects, things like the housing crisis, the recession, the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then later this is very US-centric, by the way, and later the pandemic, millennials are not becoming more conservative, even though we might not be getting as much money as the generation before us, but we are slowly making more and creating wealth and you know, developing it. But we're choosing, we're not doing the thing that has been demonstrably shown where each generation, as they grow older, they become more conservative. We're not getting more conservative. We're more collectivist, more willing to do redistribution of wealth, less tolerant of conservative viewpoints, and that this is an interesting kind of blip in the way things have been for the last century, 200-300 years, whatever it is.
Less tolerant definitely tracks, but in general, all of that sounds terrible and awful, Oshi. But no, like, it's just a weird situation. I've never bought the idea that people inherently become more conservative as they age.
It's been demonstrated by actual, like, people have been tracking it for decades. They don't know why. There's lots of reasons and there's nuances to it, but it does happen. You start voting and holding more conservative views, and the general consensus has always been is because the more stuff you have, the more you want things to stay the same, and that tends to be what conservative political thinking does.
Some of the stuff that I've seen on that had more to do with the idea that it used to be that before we had the internet and 24-hour news and all this stuff that keeps us, you know, generally up to date on what the hell's going on, it was just harder to keep track of things, so you just stuck to what you knew, and as the world moves forward, you stay roughly the same. Millennials are just inching forward a bit more, as opposed to standing still as we get older and keeping up with the times a bit better. But, like, I don't think people inherently become more conservative. They just lose track of where they are as the line continuously shifts under us all.
Okay. I mean, that's a very valid interpretation. That was one of the things that I read in the article, that communication and interactivity has and the globalization has really affected how people, like, but the point being that we're the first generation where you're seeing the effects of all of this. Economic changes, communication changes, you're seeing the effects of it. And it spells a very different way for the world to interact, because millennials are as large a cohort, I think, as the baby boomers are. So it's an interesting, like, dichotomy.
Yeah. Oh, and on the subject of the millennials thing, I was just reminded of how my favorite comedian, Christopher Titus, opened up his most recent special basically just by apologizing to millennials.
Oh my god, I saw that.
Yeah, I actually got to see that in person. I drove out to catch him when he was in South or North Carolina, one of the Carolinas. And it was just so funny to me because he has historically, you know, used millennials as a punching bag like many comedians do and should continue to do so. And he's just like, yeah, you know what? It occurs to me that, like, when you track the number of global catastrophes and life-shattering, defining events that have happened in your short, tiny lifespans, I get it now.
Yeah.
You can take your safe space and, you know, go hug a kitten in it or something. You've earned it.
I love that. I think that was a good, like, there's a reason why millennials look for these kind of things. When the world is this scary and we're the first generation where we have to, like, nobody before us had to deal with the internet giving us all of this news about how horrifying the world is every minute of every day of every second of our lives.
I think that in general, life has been difficult and hard and shitty for people throughout history. And in general, almost every generation is the first generation to deal with some catastrophic world-shaping problem to them. And I do have a real, like, complaint that I think the internet has kind of warped our perspective a bit on this, because I hear a lot of people in our generation and in Gen Z who really do sound like they think that, what's what I'm looking for here?
I think we're going off on a tangent too much.
Oh yeah, we are going off on maybe too much of a tangent. This is a whole, like, whole-ass discussion, and we barely even have time for a half-assed discussion. So we'll leave this at quarter-assed done, which I do believe is about the appropriate amount.
But I wanted to bring this up because, yeah, I'm thinking about how it ties back into the whole TWI stuff. The reason I wanted to bring this up was...
Gotta get isekai'd to find some land. Oh, God. I am at the point now where I'm shopping housing stuff. And actually, housing was really good the past few years. And the moment that it's, like, feasible for me to gain entry, this goddamn interest rate bullshit happens.
I'm in the same place. I'm waiting for the inevitable three-year, like, cycle. Let's not... No, I don't want to talk...
This is way too much adulting in real life. I am not discussing finances. I'm here to escape that.
Yeah, so I'm not even in a place where I level in any case. The bigger moment is I'm trying to tie this back into TWI. How was I trying to do that? I was thinking about generational effects on, like, on fiction as well. We have these changing perspectives in how we deal with communication, how we deal with things, and I mean we're talking about these web serials that are everything new is old again, as you said once, multiple times, many times, about how things cycle back. But the reason we're reflecting back onto these old things and reinventing them, so to speak, in this new medium is just because we need more viable ways to cope with the problems that you're talking about. Every generation has dealt with it before. Like, they have some kind of cultural or social shock that forces them to deal with something. And millennials, I think, are reaching backwards in time to translate all of the things that used to be stuff we take comfort in. Magazines and stories and trading information or letters and all these things that we used to use. And we're translating them into this modern tech-based infrastructure. And then it's trickling down from us to Gen Z who now have this basis of translated materials to work for. Millennials translated the non-tech world into the tech world, and now Gen Z, who are native to the tech world, what are they going to translate it into? What are they going to create? And all of this made me think, holy crap, millennials got really shafted. We don't even get to be creative. We're just taking old stuff and putting it into new places. And we're the ultimate in transitional generation, and transitions are exactly what Volume 3 is a lot about, because the end of Volume 3, I think mentally for me, is one of the biggest transitional moments. See how clever I was? Huh? Huh?
Yes, yes. Very clever, Oshi. It was more clever before you pointed it out, though.
Shut up. But the point being, so when we left off our last discussion, Ryoko was leaving Magnolia's mansion after having read the Antinium War. Is this when she reads the Antinium Wars, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so she reads about the Antinium Wars, and it's revealed a lot about, or at least from the perspective of one particular, pretty biased asshole, Drake.
Well, for the first book, he was pretty, like...
Was he?
Yeah, I remember for the first book, he wasn't so bad. It was the second book where he really, like, started tearing into it.
Yeah.
Like, we had a whole discussion about it when we did, like, the standalone episode on it, but
yeah,
you weren't on that one, I just remembered.
I was not, but in any case, Ryoko reads these books, and the big thing that I took away from it all was that there is a complex history to this world. Pirate builds this depth that there is a complex history, and even in the writing of these chapters, Pirate writes down the viewpoint of the writer of the... Okay, this is a story, very Scheherazade, story within a story within a story, because it's just like any kind of modern politically driven or propaganda driven writing, piece of writing. There is truth to it, there is lies to it, there is shading to it. If you were a kid in the 90s, like I was, and you read history books in New York City, they were very different from history books in, say, Oklahoma, because Oklahoma might have like one paragraph about the civil rights movement, and the one in New York City would have like a full chapter about the civil rights movement. And this is very much felt like one of those moments where Chrisell Wordsmith was writing this thing about the Antinium Wars, and we see how magnificent Magnolia is, and the Antinium are framed as these unknowable, dark creatures that are committing genocide, and it all, like, all these set pieces play out, and you see Ryoka's perspective being shaped by it, but at the same time, you're like, these are not the people that we know. Zell is not this. Is Kilbukich this? And you kind of question it, and it's really good construction.
Yeah. Well, another interesting thing about the way that, like, he presents it and the way everything gets framed and the story within a story, I like the way that you can almost feel between when he tells the story of the first Antinium War and the second Antinium War, the cooling off of relations between humans and drakes, because he wrote the first one when they were all feeling, you know, great and happy, and the second war just ended and everybody was all fuzzy. And then he writes the second one a little while later, and now, you know, Drake supremacy, rah, rah, rah.
Yeah, you can... It's the subtle notes that make a difference. And that subtlety is what carries over into Ryoka's journey in Invisril, where she meets Laken the Godar, the Emperor of River Farm, who has now, like, Goddard, who arrives in Invisril looking for relief for his people, and he does the classic the broken bird scenario where you create a broken bird and somebody vulnerable and see how people react, and you pick the ones that are more honorable. He does some clever emperor bullshit, but mostly it's there to show that he's smart. He's just smart.
He's wily, and he has a good mind for, like, being around a bunch of manipulative people who want something from him and could be wanting to take advantage of him. Which makes sense for somebody with a disability where he's often at the mercy of others.
Right, and the meeting between Ryoka and Laken is a big deal, because they truly do discuss some important aspects, and she just... And for somebody who's being so careful about knowledge when it comes to Magnolia, she shares with Laken some pieces of information that she thinks is not going to be a big deal. Like, what was it she talked
to? Trebuchets. Because they're on the same team.
Yeah,
and
they're on,
like,
the same team.
It shows, you know, for all of, like, her issue, you know, Ryoka wants to help support and create a ecosystem where the various Earthers out there can... succeed. Also, he has an Articuno, so, like,
that's what I was gonna, like, he shows her, they show each other their phones. But the big thing that happens is a phone call occurs coincidentally when the two of them are in the room talking to each other, and it's Black Mage, and Black Mage is trying to, like, save people and bring them to Wistrom, and obviously both Laken and Ryoka are not stupid enough to fall for it or tell anybody their names or anything like that. And it's just this wonderful, like, meeting of the minds, coupled with showing off Laken and showing off Ryoka, because Ryoka also does some dealings in Infrasil too, because she's there for the horns. And while she's in the midst of trying to do her dealing, she cons some of the maids into helping her, and she gloms off to the Runner's Guild to talk to Eren and get all things missed. I loved you.
And quite accidentally puts Laken on Magnolia's radar.
Right, and remember that whole sequence when she's talking to Eren, because Eren is trying to find a solution for Brunker's infected wound.
Yeah.
And she hints at the fact that you can use honey and disinfectant, and that there's a specific mold that you can find that will produce penicillin. So I'm trying to make a point here that, oh, I'm going to be super careful with Magnolia, but she just, like, penicillin, trebuchets.
Well, yeah, because she was helping out the Earthers. Okay, for one, I'm going to just say that in a life or death situation, to help someone from Earth who isn't herself, for obvious reasons we've talked about before, I think Ryoka's absolutely willing to break a lot of those rules and, like, say, you know, let's let it through, let's talk about this and that, this needs to be done, because, like, she values their lives.
She does. I did want to take a moment to talk about two relatively minor characters that get some unfortunate levels of screen time here. Like, not unfortunate, but certain things happen to them. So Brunker being the first one, he tried to attack the inn and Leonette, and he got an infection. And we find out more about Brunker and what he wants and why he wants it, and why he truly desires to be a knight, a Gnoll knight. Like, that was a pretty fucking big deal. And just finding out all these little things about him and developing him as a character was pretty cool. And then we also find out, or at least Ryoka does, that she got her runner courier friend, who gave her the thing that broke the Gaius, that stopped her from remembering that Tariarch is a dragon. What was his name?
Well, it doesn't really matter, because he's dead now.
Oh, he's dead now. But it matters! It was
Falls, I think?
No. It was... No, Falls is somebody else.
No. Falls is somebody else.
Yeah.
Who's another character who's present and around here, but God, if I can remember Falls doing much of this volume.
Yeah, he kind of falls away. Valsif. That's what it was. I knew it was some kind of V name. So Valsif dies to some bandits who cast a sleep spell on him, and he just gets caught and killed, and it's horrible and terrible. And of course Ryoka is grieving him too. But I think the most important part for me of all of that is not Ryoka taking on somebody else's pain for herself again. It's the subtle ways Pirate is, like, setting up all these big things and using the slice of life aspects to do it. here is an emperor announcing himself in one of the most powerful ladies'
domain.
Yeah, domain. Here is Wistrom Academy hunting earthers using Black Mage. And here is Eren suddenly finding about penicillin and interacting with this guy. And in the middle of it, Pirate also drops the wand. You want to talk about how the enchanter guy?
Yeah, I love the way that, like, Pirate Abba almost casually slides into the room and just goes ahead and sets out all of this stuff and all this chapter, and then when you're not looking, slips in this moment of, like, real fucking magic and wonder and just... It is so goddamn cool and interesting, and there's all these great items, and then there's the wand, which is apparently some sort of almost literal artifact of fucking magic, living magic, and like the spirit of life. It has got so much cool shit in it, and honestly,
it's Hedalt, by the way, is the mage who is a whole...
It is a shame that they have two wizards in that party and that, like, it just could not come home with her, which got them even more cool items. But
I mean, I don't think it was too much of a shame, because I loved the fact that Ryoka convinced Ivaleth to tell that story. And the story ends with, within this wand is a seed. It's a seed. Seeds grow. It means things are going to happen. Like, look at the symbology of all the things Pirate's setting up. And you're like...
Yeah, it's this great, like, metaphor for the seed that, you know, that then gets planted and grows into the future of the horns with all these startup items.
All these, like, motifs the Pirate, whether intent... I don't know if it was intentional or not, but the Pirate set it all up. Here are the seeds of all of the stories that I'm going to tell you, and I'm using this slice of life adventure in the city of adventurers, which I guess we don't talk much about. Honestly, that's probably Pirate's fault. They don't do a really good job, like, developing Inversil as, like, a unique place. It's very...
It feels like Selim, but bigger, is, like, the best way I can think of to describe it.
Yeah, and... It does, for minor tiny spoiler, we do get better, like, sense of the city, but even today, I don't think I have as good a sense of Invisil or its personality as I do of other cities. But yeah, and that's a fault of Pirate Abba's that I don't think... It took a long time for Pirate to address that, and they do, eventually. But the coolness of the story, and then... do you remember what happens with Eren? Do you want to take the Eren part?
Well, I think that what we get to next with Eren is the somewhat tragic and ill-advised Christmas party.
Before that, we have the whole, like, we dropped off on it, but Eren did something when she come back to...
Oh yeah, she set up the door in Inversil and hired some maids and made some enemies.
No.
All right, Oshi, just do it. Just go.
Yeah. So, she hears about the terrible news of what happens to Esthelm when Ysera's brother gets there with the silver swords and the goblins and everything is happening, and she's like, "You know what? It's time to do something about this." And it's what, as I was talking about the end of last episode, it's what impresses Zell the most. A couple of the scenes that makes me love Zell as a character so much, even, it's not even in hindsight, in that moment, I love Zell as a character so much, and Pawn, of course. So Eren goes crazy, and she runs out, and she starts telling people, "Hey, I got a plan, let's go do stuff," and she starts gathering up the band, and everybody just, like, follows her, and Liskor's newly leveled 30 strategist, Olesum, just goes and does, just... gets up with her. Everybody's like, "Who is this girl?" No, not everybody. What is his name? The Drake guy, the other guy who came with the Lord. What is his name?
Ilvris.
Yeah, Ilvris is like, "Who the hell is this girl? Why are you so obsessed with her?" And then she does this. She convinces the Antinium, who never leave their city, to come help and to do all of this, and Kilbakich goes along with it. And all of the painted Antinium and all these folks, and she gathers everybody together, convinces different human cities to help, and puts her door, which they figure out how, like, the mathematics of it, which, if only Pirate was good at math.
I'm not gonna lie, for scenes like that, I have a personal habit of just sort of tuning out and waiting for them to tell me what they want me to believe it says. I can't do math either, so what's the point in reading it?
There it is, and then what happens is that she runs a refugee train with the help of everybody. She brings food and relief to Esthelm, which is devastated, and there is a statue of a flower girl, and there is a city that's broken, and there is a girl who's singing Christmas carols and trying to bring the spirit of Christmas to this city that doesn't have any hope, and trying to bring hope. And in the middle of all of this, all these little bits and bobs about hope and things, Zurn is, the small queen, is like, why are we doing this? What is going on? And she observes, and she sees as Pawn, the so-called leader of the Painted Antinium, goes up to Zell's Fivertail as if he can just do that, because doesn't matter what else he does, he just does that, and asks him, how can you help me with something? And Zell immediately reacts with, like, no, you're a fucking Antinium. Get the fuck away from me. I'm going to kill you if you step near me. And then Pawn just asks him, what do you do for a soldier who's going to die? And it's just this, it was one of the most heart-rending moments for me. I still remember it. It's one of the biggest scenes because Zell doesn't reject him. He could have pushed him away. He could have been anything, but to him, it mattered more that a soldier was treated with respect than whether or not it was his enemy, it was the person who killed his...
If there was ever a singular question to get to the heart and soul of Zell's Shivertail and who he is and what he believes that could build so much empathy in an exact moment and really bridge that gap, it was that one right there.
Yeah. And it bridged the gap. Zurn got to see it. Kilbukich got to see it. And Aaron did that. And it's the most subtle... Well, not Aaron. Pawn did that. But Aaron was instrumental in it.
It's the thing that's magical about the Aaron and the inn. And just what I find so wonderful about it. It's that she brings all these people together. And they bounce off of one another, and their minds expand, and their horizons broaden, and they interact, and it creates this really magical situation that, like, that's why those are always my favorite chapters, when we get to see characters meet.
And it's why we, Pirate, likely chose the inn setting, because it allows for that. But the other thing, there's a little bit of a naivete here, where if we just spoke to one another and just respected one another and just heard each other out, we'd find we'd have more in common than we have, like, different from each other.
Yeah, but it's a naivete that you can find at the core of a lot of stories. Hell, even really dark ones. Like,
that's true.
Fucking, I mentioned Gundam earlier, we were talking about anime stuff, but the entire core concept of new types in Gundam was that if humanity could just understand each other and communicate on a level beyond words, then we could maybe become better people on all end war. And instead, you just got two people who understood how well they hated each other and died screaming while trying to murder each other. So, you know, like, it's a wonderful thought and feeling, and I'm happy to see it. It gives me the warm fuzzies. I like it.
Yeah, and I loved it, and I thought it was a really good way to, like, bookend the Esthelm chapters. And it was also, I don't think it's explicitly said, but this was Aaron making up for what she did too, right?
Yeah, with Torin.
She's asking for forgiveness. Yeah, with Torin and releasing Torin and all that. And it's a very quiet way of, it's not spoken of, and it's not like everybody knows it, but I kind of think there was a missed opportunity here for Pirate to sort of more explicitly tie in Aaron's own guilt. Maybe have a scene where she, like, I don't know. There was some writing and missed opportunities.
There are ideas. I like though that Esslm, between the goblins, the flower girl, and now this conversation between Zell and Pawn, has almost become this place in the story where terrible things have happened, but where people have come together and grown and learned through it.
Yeah. So after that, I guess, after they get back to the inn from the and she leaves a doorway and she connects back and everybody goes home, Erin's next part is, well, it's time to have a Christmas party. And she starts the tradition of everybody having Secret Santas and tells everybody about it and invites everybody, and she decides to have a huge party. While on the other end of the world, or at the other end of it, Ryoka is delivering Christmas gifts because Erin can't help but spread the Christmas cheer to all the world from Laken to his to all the children of River Farm, and she's following this Rudolph the Red-Nosed Ivolith.
Yeah, everything about that scene where, like, they very clearly and obviously just manipulate Ivalith in the best way to manipulate any fae, ego.
The fact that it even worked was glorious. It's always the immortals who are so mortal in their foibles.
God, there's a line. It's from, like, I think a Team Four Star parody. Oh, it's from Helsinger Bridge, where it's like, I know you're playing me, but go on.
So she ends up going, and there's this giant storm coming, so she needs the help, and Ivalith leads her through the storm. And Erin starts up her party, and everybody notices at the start of the party that Erin may be a little. They don't quite notice it. And there's lots of interactions and all the nice things that you were talking about, where people meet each other and like they give each other gifts, and it's sweet and nice. And there's mistletoe, and Erin tries to sing a song, and she breaks down and cries because she's exhausted herself helping everybody else. Because she doesn't want to remember the fact that she's not home for Christmas.
Yeah, I'll be home for the holidays was perhaps not the correct choice, but it was an understandable one. And Erin, yeah, she just puts so much out there and just tries so hard and helps all these people. But in her own way, she is as lacking in self-awareness and just, what's the word? Something is Ryoka. She's.
What?
I don't know.
Okay, well, there is some similarity between the two of them. I did like the nice touch of Erin crying in her room where nobody can see her, or on the roof where nobody can
On the
see her.
roof,
Yeah,
yeah.
on the roof where nobody could see her. I did appreciate that moment, and it's just like there are things that are part of it that sort of bookend everything. Not necessarily, but they made a sense. And it's really cool that everybody sort of dipped out. Wait, was this the one where the players of Selim came and then Erin made a claim about? Oh yeah, right after she like starts crying and runs away, everybody at the party like.
Yeah, she mentioned a dragon, and everyone's like, "Oh, no." They start talking about her because everyone's trying to piece together who she is and where she came from because she is kind of mysterious and has a lot going on. And Kilb and Relk mention about how when they met her, she had said something about being chased by a dragon, and everybody has a good laugh. And then, out of all the people, Grev, who you will put respect upon his name, is the one who catches out Kilbekich in his Not a Lie.
Because Kilbekich is very, very good at doing what anybody who's lived a long, long time gets to do, is to tell you exactly the perfect truth and leave you to make the interpretation.
In a world with truth stones, it's a goddamn necessity of a skill.
Even without truth stones, it's just something like an old person skill. I don't know why, but that's what I call it. Like, your parents could tell you, well, yes, we will go to Disney World. Nowhere does he they do they say when, if it'll happen tomorrow. No details, just it'll ha it, we'll go to Disney World when pigs fly. Like, it's that kind of energy for me. In any case, that happens, everybody goes off, Relk and Kilbekich act like Santa Claus, which is hilarious. Everybody exchanges gifts. Eren does come back after her crying Jag, but she's alone, and it's the winter solstice. And on the winter solstice, Ryoka is running with Christmas gifts, and Eren Solstice wakes at her inn all alone. And when she wakes up, she has three new guests who come in.
Three spooky, mysterious guests in a chapter that speaks in more metaphor than in word.
It's pirates attempt to write a fairy tale, and boy, is it a fairy tale. Eren experiences another moment like the one she did when she went to the nearly pulled the sword out of the stone. And it is such a, 360 changeover, genre shift. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? Who are these three guys? One's like a dancer. One's got a giant beard. And he's like all the sternness of rulers. And the next one, what was the other one?
I think I might be getting them mixed up. Was the dancer?
There were three of them. One was a sort of dancer and hunter who could, like... One was a stern dude, and the last one was... I can't remember what the last one was.
Neither can I. I mostly remember the ones that came to talk to Ryoka, because Ryoka definitely got a batch of fucking assholes. Fucking darkness and strangeness and karma.
Right! Ryoka also meets some people on the way... Because she's freezing, and these shady, like, women in the dark that Ivalith immediately tells her to turn around, not go to the fire. And yet, of course, Ryoka can't stop herself. And she ends up in the fire on the side of the road with these three dark, shaded, evil figures. And on parallel, Eren is with these three gentlemen. I swear to God, I can't remember the description. I have to look this up.
Ryoka did not have three gentlemen. Ryoka had two women and a what the fuck is that?
Yeah, Ryoka had two women and a what the fuck was that? And
Eren had...
three men. I just can't remember what the descriptions are because I'm trying to avoid spoilers.
Yeah, well, one thing is, this is, so there's no way, I think, for us to talk about this without giving up a little bit of the ghost, but for those of you who are reading along or on the audiobooks, oh boy, is this important. That's probably not a spoiler, but...
Okay, it doesn't matter what they were described as. Eren provides them with food, the three men who visit her, she provides them with food and gives them a chance to, like, stay at her inn, and... In return, they don't have money, so in return, because she was such a kind host, they offer her three objects. A hangman's rope, an umbrella, or was it an umbrella?
Yeah, a hangman's rope, an umbrella, and a horn.
And a horn. And each of them offers a different one. The hangman's rope comes from the guy who looked, that I remember now, like he had ink stains on his hands, like he was like a studying person. The hangman's noose comes from the ink stain guy, the horn comes from the dancer, and the umbrella? Was it? I swear to God, I can't believe it's an umbrella. An umbrella comes from the...
That shines with like the light of the sun and is glorious and radiant. Don't just undersell this umbrella for being an umbrella.
I'm sorry, it was just so weird that it was an umbrella, but I mean, it's very pirate. And she's flattered, and like they're so beautiful, and she's hypnotized, and she builds up to this moment where she reveals that in return for this gift that they're gonna give her, they want her soul. Motherfucker, they want her soul.
And in her own strange, wonderful, humble way, Eren completely dodges the soul-stealing monsters by saying, honestly, these gifts are too good for me. I couldn't take one of them.
And they leave her disappointed with a shining silver coin. And that's Eren's experience with these mysterious people on the height of the winter solstice. And on the other side of the world, Ryoka does not have as fun a time.
No. Ryoka, befitting her nature, gets the asshole. kills. She gets the spooky being who, when seen, almost gives you a feeling of terrible vertigo as this darkness made flesh just pulls you into and makes you consider the horrors that are about to become your life.
And then the three beings, by the way, are described as like this figure who's like shifting forms of three different women. One who looks like a young with a blade, another that's like the weird, creepy darkness person. And she's like freaked out and she can't get out of it. And they say, you can't leave. You can't leave the fire. If you leave the fire, you're going to end up dead. And Ryoka, she loses a finger. All I know is, I just can't remember the rest of it, but she loses a fucking finger.
Well, no, she lost two fingers. One of them just opens up their hand and offers them back. They're very clearly trying to get real. Their used car salesman pushy on her for a deal here, which is always a sign that, you know, the things that you're talking to are clearly friendly. But what I really love is the 3-in-1, like, sort of Hecate reference that you're getting with that one. And it definitely leads one to have a lot of ideas and thoughts and concerns, and Ryoka somehow manages to not fuck this up.
She just barely gets out of the way, and Ivaleth helps her get away, and Ivaleth tells her never to speak their names, never to speak of them again, to forget they ever existed, and to run. And she does. And you know what?
Listening for once in her life.
Oh my god, thank god she did. Like, and then what happens next is what happens afterwards is that she arrives in River Farm. Ryoka gets to give out presents.
That's when she was leaving River Farm.
You're right, it's after she arrived and gave the presents.
Yeah, because on her way there there's a big snowstorm, and then Frosty the snow golem, who's 10 tons and 80 feet tall, comes in to give her the assist.
Right, you're right, it was very Christmassy. But then, and she gets caught on the way back, right?
Yeah, Ryoka being Ryoka, refusing to stay and enjoy a nice warm cup of cocoa with the nice farm folk, decides to go get ambushed by a fucking goon squad of what the fucks in the middle of the woods. So typical Ryoka things.
I mean, that became the basis of a mystery that haunted me for so long, because there were so many references that sort of like went above my head, because I knew those references. They were so familiar. It felt like a Harry Potter story with the whole hangman's noose thing that would let her, like, hide from death, and the whole umbrella with light thing. And then at the other end, we have Ryoka and the side of the road with the three, like, things on. Like, there are stories about devils and offers. There's just so many cool things here. And I just could not, like, quantify it. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to step away and I'm going to let Pyre read it. And write it and we'll see where it goes.
It is a baller way to end a book. And it definitely helped, because like I said, I think I've mentioned a few times that I was doing truck driving when I started reading this, and the timing of it was such that it was not like that far off from Christmas itself. That was my first Christmas on the road when I was reading this. Mm-hmm. And the Aaron scene really got me as a result, actually.
Yeah.
Like, and then you just have this baller way to close out the fucking book, and just immediately, next thing I know, I'm 50 chapters into the next one. All of my emotion is gone.
Okay. So we go through all this. The book ends on the winter solstice. And Pirate has their way with us with a giant mystery while also wrapping up a bunch of different talls. And like I said, planting all these little seeds for all these stories that will soon come. And that's the end of Volume 3. I enjoyed Volume 3 in its parts. I did not necessarily enjoy Volume 3 in its totality.
You see, I am like in the exact opposite. I really enjoyed it in its totality and just think it was a lot better than the sum of its parts, which some of them I wasn't super wild about, some of them I liked.
Yeah, I just enjoyed certain parts of like Zell's introduction and Ilvers's introduction and Torin and Esthelm and the consequences of the Flower Girl stuff, like I said, the return of the fact that the Antinium ended up being able to help the way they did. And
oh yeah, don't misunderstand me. There are moments in here I absolutely love, like they are some of my absolute favorites. That entire Flower Girl and Goblin plot line is my favorite plot line of, like, the entire story. It's just, I think that I like the volume more than I liked a lot of the other individual parts, is all.
Okay, so on that note, I guess that's the end of Volume 3 for us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a journey. We'll try to be a little bit cleaner when it comes to Volume 4.
Which I believe with Volume 4, we're probably, I think, looking at moving to tackling them more by, like, book by the Amazon publishing, as
yes.
opposed to trying to take it on as the whole volume at once. It was an interesting experiment. I think there's some real, like, cool stuff that we could do if we expanded this current format more, but ultimately the volumes are just going to get too big.
It's just too much, but if we follow the book formatting, I think it'll be a little bit easier. So from this point forward, we're just going to follow the way Pirate has sectioned the books themselves. They picked, well, at least they figured out a way to break the books up into, the volumes up into, like, books. So we'll be doing that. We'll talk about it more about next episode, and I'm good if you're good. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
All right, bye everybody.
Bye everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.